Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Money has emerged as an important divider in the 2020 Democratic presidential field. Money ended California Senator Kamala Harris's campaign, and it's why billionaires like Tom Steyer and former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg could become competitive despite entering the race late in the game. And always underneath fundraising questions are the bigger questions about the role of money in politics. On Sunday, Elizabeth Warren used Senator Harris's departure to tie the issue to race, gender, and corruption in politics. Last week, Warren disclosed some financials of her private legal work. There are questions about whether she did work in the past inconsistent with her image. And Senator Warren challenged former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg to be transparent about his work at the Wall Street consulting firm McKinsey and to open his private high-dollar fundraisers to the press. Here is Warren last week.
It is even more important that the candidates expose possible conflicts of interest right now. And that means that the mayor should be releasing who's on his finance committee, who are the bundlers who are raising big money for him, who he's given titles to and made promises to. And he should open up the doors. And no one should be left to wonder what kind of promises are being made to the people who can pony up big bucks to be in the room.
So that was last Thursday in Boston, and this story is moving. There are both developments with respect to Warren and respect to Buttigieg in the last day or so. And to boot, what does it say that Michael Bloomberg is spending tens of millions of dollars per week in these first weeks of his campaign, and suddenly, poof, he's at 6% in the polls? Mayor de Blasio never got to like 1% in the polls. Would he have if he had spent $30 million a week? I'm not saying he would have, but I'm saying there's no way to know. Joining me to talk about money in politics, Democratic Presidential Race Edition, is Amanda Turkle, the HuffPost's Washington Bureau Chief. Amanda, thanks so much for doing this. Welcome to WNYC Today.
Thank you for having me.
Regarding Mayor Pete first, you wrote in the HuffPost yesterday that the policy surrounding his fundraisers is the most secretive of any of the front runners. And yet I think there's a development that Buttigieg bowed to pressure yesterday and announced that they'll now be open. So tell us what has been and what's new here as you see it.
Sure. Well, Pete Buttigieg obviously has had an incredible rise. He was a little known mayor in Indiana and is suddenly considered, you know, in the pack of frontrunners for the Democratic nomination. And he's done so in large part, obviously, because of his charisma and this appeal that he has for people, but also because he's been able to raise a ton of money to stay in the race. And you have people like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders who have this base, this grassroots army, who have been helping propel them through online donations, small dollar donations. But Pete Buttigieg has really gotten a lot of his money sort of a more traditional way, if you will, through rich donors and high dollar fundraisers. And they're not open to the press. And he initially released a list of bundlers. And these are the people who raise large amounts of money for his campaign. And so those don't show up necessarily in fundraising reports, and it's up to the campaign to release them. He did that initially, but since then, suddenly, since April, he stopped. And so there have been a lot of questions about why, what's he hiding, if anything, and if he's not hiding anything, why doesn't he release the bundler names and allow the press into his fundraisers? And Joe Biden also does these big dollar fundraisers, but he allows the press in, although he doesn't allow bundlers' names to be released. And Kamala Harris, before she dropped out, did release her bundler names, although she didn't allow the press into her fundraisers. So you have candidates doing different things. But now Buttigieg, after pressure, said, I will allow press into fundraisers and I will release the bundler names again.
And the Money in Politics website, The Sludge, wrote, a review of Buttigieg's known bundlers shows why his campaign is reluctant to disclose the names going forward. It listed backers that include Steve Elmendorf, who represents healthcare companies opposed to Medicare for All. There's also Blackstone executive Hamilton James. Blackstone is the world's largest private equity firm that takes billions from Saudi Arabia, among many other controversial things regarding Blackstone. There's also Stephen Patton, a Chicago lawyer who worked to block release of the video that depicted the police shooting of black teenager Laquan McDonald in 2014. How do you think this affects his image politically, if you want to do some political analysis, and his fundraising going forward if he's making changes?
Well, Buttigieg has always positioned himself as a more moderate, more business, more corporate-friendly candidate than some of the other candidates in the race. And so, you know, if he is providing more transparency now around his donors and around his fundraisers, you know, that's obviously a win for the public, but it will create more questions, perhaps, and more news stories about who he's associating with. And it creates questions for the candidate of, well, do you agree with what this person's doing? You know, do you think what they're doing is good for democracy? And it just, there are all sorts of things that you have to answer for. You know, allowing press into fundraisers can be tricky for candidates. If you think back to past election cycles, Mitt Romney and his 47% comment, that was at a closed-door fundraiser that someone secretly recorded. Barack Obama, when he made his comment about clinging to guns and religion, that was a story we broke on HuffPost. It was, again, someone who went to a fundraiser that wasn't open to the press. And so candidates have a tendency to be more open, to be more honest, and to be more cavalier when they think they're just speaking to these high-dollar donors than they do at these big rallies that are open to the public. And so Buttigieg now may have to be more careful about what he says at these. But, you know, it's a win for the public to see what's going on behind closed doors.
Definitely more cavalier. Remember how big a thing it was in 2016 that Bernie Sanders was trying to leverage Hillary Clinton and her campaign to release the texts of closed-door speeches that she gave to Goldman Sachs and other Wall Street companies for like hundreds of thousands of dollars at a pop. And then funny enough, they finally came out in the Russia WikiLeaks hack of all those emails, and there wasn't much there. And these weren't campaign fundraisers, but there's the question of what, you know, politicians running for high office say behind closed doors when they're taking in a lot of money one way or the other. Why wouldn't they all open the fundraisers to the press? I mean, I honestly scratch my head at this, Amanda. What's up, Pete Buttigieg? What's up, anybody trying to hide with respect to what they would say in a campaign context to people who they're asking for money?
That's a great question, and that's something I've been thinking about a lot, too, the past few days. You know, I think that candidates just feel like they can be more comfortable when they're talking to donors if the press isn't there. And perhaps the donors are more comfortable as well if the press isn't there. You know, a donor who may have these controversial ties to some company might be more willing to give money to a candidate, and the candidate might be more willing to accept it if the press won't be there poking around and asking questions, saying, who are you? Why are you here? You know, trying to reach the candidate. It's just simply easier for the candidate. But like you said, I think that the public wants to know if an individual or a corporation pays a large amount of money, what is the candidate telling them? Are they making some sort of promises? Are they saying something different than what they're saying publicly? And so, you know, with releasing the bundler names, this was a standard practice for every candidate running for president, basically up until the 2020 election. You remember George W. Bush? He had the Rangers and the Pioneers, and they sort of had these like sort of silly names.
Oh yeah, for different tiers,
which level?
Right, different tiers of donations.
And this was a standard thing up until this election cycle, when suddenly the candidates, the Democratic candidates, just decided they weren't going to do that. And they weren't really pushed very hard on this until recently. And, you know, Senator Elizabeth Warren did make it a bit of an issue. But the Buttigieg campaign, I know we and other media outlets have been pushing them for a while. When are you going to release these bundler names? Mm-hmm. And when are you going to open the fundraisers? And now the burden is on these other candidates to do so.
And listeners, we can take some phone calls on any of this regarding any candidate or just what you think the standards should be at 212-433-WNYC. Money in Politics, Democratic Presidential Race Edition with Amanda Turkle, the HuffPost's Washington Bureau Chief, 212-433-9692. Yeah, and the taint doesn't even have to come from anything scandalous that's been said, like Romney's 47% comment or whatever. You know, again, I go back to the Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton in 2016, even though the text of those speeches when they came out turned out not to be very damning. You know, like Hillary Clinton was not out there saying, oh, don't worry about the financial crisis. We won't change the banking rules. Nothing like that. But just the fact that she was taking such money from such sources and not being willing to disclose as like a second offense, you know, was a lot of leverage for Sanders and was a legitimate issue. I saw this morning, Amanda, Warren getting dinged on MSNBC around the same issue, more or less. It was about using Harvard stationery, defending a development company, trying to get out of paying for an environmental cleanup of toxic waste at a rail yard. And the Warren campaign says there was no question the rail yard would get cleaned up. This wasn't in defense of pollution. The only question was which company would pay, and she was getting paid for her services in the context of the bankruptcy of the company she was representing. She's been a bankruptcy lawyer. So are you familiar with this story yet?
Yeah. And so if you, it obviously, you know, Elizabeth Warren representing corporations, especially in cases regarding pollution or something like that, certainly cuts against her image. And, you know, I think that if you look at what the Warren campaign is saying, the Warren campaign says that, yes, she did do this, but the issue was bankruptcy laws. That is what she was interested in defending and making sure that there was a strong system in place to protect individuals, consumers, and businesses when needed. And that was her interest here. And they're saying that, you know, this wasn't about making sure that a company wouldn't have to pay. It was a question of which company would have to pay for the cleanup, because some company would. You know, you can buy that. There are some individuals who were involved with the case at the time saying, look, no, the companies fighting this, even against each other, made it harder to get money for the cleanup. And, you know, it was bad overall that there was this other case going on. So, you know, Warren raised, she got about $2 million over 30 years for her corporate legal work. That's not really a huge amount of money, sort of in the grand scheme of things, considering she was a top bankruptcy lawyer. She was actually getting paid lower than some of her peers. And, you know, obviously, again, her expertise was in demand. But this isn't something I think you would see Elizabeth Warren doing now. And it's certainly something that I think she'll be hit on by her Democratic candidates, probably by President Trump, because it does just sort of go against what her image is as she's running in 2020.
Jim in the South Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'd just like to question the narrative that money is the determinant in campaigns. Regarding Senator Harris, for instance, she's from by far the largest and richest state in the country. She's a statewide candidate elected in California. The fact that she wasn't able to raise money should tell you something about her lack of support. And I think that, and by contrast, Bernie Sanders, who is a small state that's not especially rich, has a very broad donor base. I think the ability to raise money or not is an expression of support more than anything else, rather than the cause of the viability or unviability of a campaign. I think it should be looked at that way.
Jim, thank you very much. Amanda, what are you thinking?
I definitely see his point in some respect. You know, Bernie Sanders absolutely has broad national support. Again, he gets that money through grassroots, online, small dollar donations. You know, would you argue that if a candidate like Pete Buttigieg is raising a lot of money from a smaller number of high dollar donors because he has more money, does he necessarily have more support? You know, the big issue here that we need to look at are people like Michael Bloomberg and Tom Steyer, who are billionaires. I mean, Michael Bloomberg, billionaire several times over. And he's entered the race very late. Tom Steyer was pretty late too, though. And they're essentially able to be in this race because they're billionaires and because they don't need a lot of support nationally for now to stay in the race, because they can just fund it with their own money. They don't have to spend their time fundraising. They don't have to get up a big base of supporters. Obviously, let's see what happens when the votes start coming in, how many votes Tom Steyer and Michael Bloomberg get. But for now, they're able to get national exposure. I mean, Michael Bloomberg has spent more on television and radio ads since his campaign launch on November 24th than the top four Democrats in the race combined,
right,
all year long.
Unbelievable.
He spent $60 million, and they've spent $28 million just because he's a billionaire.
The website 538 has a headline that says, Michael Bloomberg outspent the entire Democratic field in TV ads last week, and they say it's likely the most money any candidate has ever spent on TV in 1 week of any primary season. Just another way to put the same thing that you were just saying. And we could sit here and think that this is going to look grotesque to the Democratic primary electorate. And yet the new poll out today, I think it's Morning Consult, has him popping at 6%, which is more than a lot of these other people, have whose names we could recite down a list. And who we may think are quality candidates have gotten at any point. And so it raises the question, did he in effect buy that 6% just through the massive amount of exposure? And if so, what does that tell us about people's susceptibility?
I think he did buy it to some extent, yeah. I mean, you have ads running constantly. I was on YouTube just watching some kids' video for my kid, and there was a Michael Bloomberg ad that popped up right beforehand. And so people everywhere are learning who Michael Bloomberg is. And some people may think that it's disgusting there's so much money in politics and that you can basically buy this national exposure. But other people may look at it, and you have Democrats who are very, very focused on defeating Trump and say, look, Trump is rich. Why don't we have a Democratic candidate who has even more money? And, we need all the resources we can to defeat Trump. And so may look at his wealth as a huge asset. Michael Bloomberg obviously is more moderate. He's taken some, really progressive stances on things like guns, for example. But he is considered a bit more moderate. And so, I think Michael Bloomberg will have some appeal, but there is no other candidate really who could enter the race this late and be doing what he's doing without the money.
Mitch in Maplewood, you're on WNYC with Amanda Turkel, Washington Bureau Chief for HuffPost. Hi, Mitch.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Amanda. Thank you very much for taking my call. So there was what I thought was a fairly explosive editorial in the New York Times yesterday. If we think of money and exposure as being part and parcel, it was by a Democratic politician basically accusing the DCCC of choking off funding to any Democratic politician that was challenging a Democratic incumbent, to the point where the DCCC was letting vendors know that if they supported a Democratic politician who was challenging an incumbent, that vendor would be blacklisted. I thought that was really incendiary, especially if it's true. And I wonder if either of you had read that editorial and what your response to that would be.
Thank you very much, Mitch. And the DCCC, for people who don't know, is the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. So that's the party's apparatus for funding people running for Congress who are Democrats. And I didn't see the editorial, Amanda. I don't know if you did, but I'm somewhat familiar with the issue. The Democratic Party, I mean, you could say they're trying to block future Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's from launching those kinds of primary challenges. Is that what's happening?
I mean, yeah, basically. I didn't see the editorial, too, but that policy that Mitch described is exactly what's going on. It's a DCCC blacklist, and it's meant to protect, the DCCC would argue that their job is to protect their incumbents, the members already in office from both Republicans, but also from Democratic challenges. And it seems like many of the strongest Democratic challenges these days come from more progressive candidates. Obviously, the D-Trip and the Democratic establishment wanted to protect Joe Crowley, and it wasn't happy when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez won. And if it had its way, Joe Crowley would still be in office. And so you have a lot of, the problem with some of this is that people who challenge incumbents are often younger. They're often women and people of color who come from maybe more untraditional backgrounds. And so they arguably get blocked out of the process. And same with the vendors, vendors who are run by women, people of color, younger upstart companies, they often find that if they choose to work with a newer candidate to get some exposure, are they going to be penalized by the DCCC down the line? And so this policy has been really controversial and people haven't been happy with it.
And it's even some of these heads of the committees who are prominent in the impeachment process from here in New York City who are ripe to be challenged. Elliot Engel, the head of the Foreign Affairs Committee, yeah, because of some conservative views that he holds, is definitely getting a primary challenger next year. Carolyn Maloney, who's now chair of oversight, is getting a primary challenger, as I understand it, next year. Even Nadler is getting a primary challenger. And, there's some political analysis that says Nadler was out in front of a lot of other Democrats in the House on impeachment. Remember, before the Ukraine story broke at all, after the Mueller report came out and Mueller's testimony, Nadler said they're in an impeachment process, partly because the Justice Democrats, the progressive wing of the party, said if Nadler wasn't, and I don't want to misquote any individual, but I think there was a sense there that if Nadler wasn't tough enough on impeachment, he would be more subject to a strong primary challenge. Do you have any sense of that with those people?
Yeah, I mean, they are, like you said, they are all sort of facing, I think Engel and Maloney are obviously more at risk of these strong challenges, but a part of it is this generational change. All three of the lawmakers you mentioned have been there for quite some time. And I think that some of the younger, more insurgent, more activist members of the party just feel like they're a little bit out of touch. I think what sort of surprises a lot of these members sometimes is that they feel like they're very progressive. And they are, if you compare them to other members of the House from more conservative areas. But, obviously there are a lot of progressive members of the Democratic Party who are represented by these people in New York City. And they want stronger members. They want people who they feel are out there on the front lines with them. Ocasio-Cortez obviously has been joining rallies, protests, strikes, things like that. They want to see more of a fighting spirit. And so I think that's where some of these members are running into a bit of trouble. And I expect to see some really exciting primary battles on the Democratic side in 2020.
Absolutely. We're almost out of time. Can I get your quick take on the impeachment news this morning? They announced two articles of impeachment only, so they went narrow, abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. I don't think they've released the particulars, the bill of particulars that are in those two categories. We'll see what they are. But of course, there are questions about how broad, how narrow, and there are questions about how fast. What's your own take?
Yeah, I mean, these two articles of impeachment seem to be where they were going. And it seems like they want a lot of this wrapped up, I think, before Christmas, so it can go over to the Senate in the new year. I'm not super confident that you'll see many Republicans get on board with this. Republicans so far have been defending Trump. And if you don't get Republicans in the House, I think it's going to be pretty tough to get the Republicans you need in the Senate as well. You may pick up one or two in tough election races. But this is going to, public opinion on this is pretty split and pretty set right now on long partisan lines. And I think it'll probably stay like that.
HuffPost's Washington Bureau Chief Amanda Turkle, thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.